When Freddy worked swiftly to ready their gear, they heard shots ring out. At first, it was a few isolated bursts, but the rest of the men caught on, and soon full auto gunfire was spraying in almost every direction. The suppressor had eliminated the rifle's muzzle flash and had muffled the report, so it was doubtful the men outside knew from which building the shot had originated. Their reaction was to wildly pump rounds into every structure in the vicinity in what professionals referred to as a death blossom. Renegade 2-2, this is Spartan, hot extract. I say again, hot extract, over.
Roger that, Spartan, 8 mics out, a voice responded over the sound of a screaming diesel motor in the background.
Both operators had put on their helmets with the distinctive four-eyed NODs in place. Freddy had the magazines for the 7.62mm HK sniper rifle in his vest, so he carried the larger rifle. Reese checked the Atpal laser on his little MP7 submachine gun and nodded to his partner, who removed the 2x4 blocking the door and opened it, allowing Reese to creep into the deserted hallway. The sniper pair moved quickly but quietly toward the stairwell at the end of the hall, hearing animated voices from the apartments they passed. The residents of Institute were apparently unhappy with the power being shut off during their prime TV watching time, not to mention the hail of bullets just outside their doors. They made it to the stairs and took the 2 flights down in seconds, pausing at the bottom to ensure that the hallway was clear. Halfway down the narrow ground floor hallway, a beam of light washed out their night vision and they heard a female scream. A surprised young woman dropped a flashlight and sprinted down the hall. The men raced to catch her, but she had too much of a head start.
"Polisi! Polisi!"
she screamed as she burst through the metal doors and out into the open area between the buildings, pointing back the way she'd come. Reese rounded the corner just in time to see a burst of tracers cut her down, the fire shifting to the doors. He dove back inside as the bullets impacted the concrete walls and metal doors, sending shards of dust and debris across the small entryway. Back on his feet, he and Freddy made their way swiftly toward the building's only other exit. When they reached the side door, which was propped open with a rock the size of a soccer ball, they saw the headlights of a pickup truck racing toward their position. One of the terrorists riding in the bed of the truck had a belt-fed PKM machine gun resting over the cab and began firing toward the open doorway. Both men dropped to the ground and Freddy began firing methodically toward the PKM's muzzle flash while Reese put a long burst into the truck's windshield. The firing stopped and the engine's whine slowed to an idle. The truck's momentum carried it forward as the pace slowed while both operators shifted their fire to the headlights. The lull in the fire was temporary as the enemy began to zero in on the American's location. Within moments, more small arms fire impacted around the doorway.
"I'll cover the other door," Reese yelled over the gunfire. "How far out is Ox?"
"Renegade 2-2, what's your ETA, over?"
Freddy called over the radio.
"Under 5, I say again, under 5.
Reese heard the transmission and flashed Freddy a thumbs up as he jogged down the hallway. Rounds still passed through both of the building's openings, preventing either man from returning effective fire. Green tracers from a belt-fed weapon ricocheted as they impacted the walls of the hallway, and 5.45mm AK rounds hit in a less frequent but equally deadly tempo. Reese slowly worked an angle on the doorway, firing short bursts as enemy muzzle flashes worked their way into his line of sight.
"I need a window!"
Reese heard his frustrated teammate call out. Seconds later, he heard the sound of a door being kicked in and the screams of the residents inside. The window gave Freddy a better position, and after he dropped 2 terrorists with as many shots, the firing from that side of the building abated as the survivors took cover behind the bullet-laden pickup truck.
"Moving your way," Reese said into his radio.
Freddy fired repeated rounds into the truck to keep the enemy's heads down as Reese moved to exit the side door, scanning the area outside to ensure that he wasn't going to walk into a burst of machine gun fire. Satisfied that it was as quiet as it was going to get, he sprinted through the door and ran around to the back side of the apartment building, where he took a knee to cover Freddy's exit. He didn't have to say a word. Instead, he fired short bursts from his MP7 under the pickup, his laser dancing across the open ground. Two of the rounds caught a shooter in the shin and he fell to his side, grasping his leg. The next burst hit his face. Freddy moved past Reese and took cover behind a small car, firing toward the enemy. They leapfrogged slowly, putting distance between themselves and the terrorist gunmen. The scene was First World versus Third. Trained versus untrained. Disciplined versus undisciplined. Reese and Freddy moved, fired, and changed magazines with practiced discipline while the terrorists sprayed rounds wildly on full automatic. The technological advantage of the NODs and IR laser-equipped former frogmen was almost unfair. The terrorists fired at fleeting sounds and shadows while Reese and Freddy could clearly see not only the enemy but each other's lasers. To the commanders and analysts stateside watching the scene from the black-and-white UAV feed, it was like watching a video game with the sound muted. IR strobes blinked on top of the helmets of the good guys, while the bad guys' muzzle flashes identified them with nearly equal clarity. Rick Ox Andrews had earned his nickname as a 19-year-old Ranger Private First Class by running across the runway of the Port Salinas Airport in Grenada under fire, laden like an ox with a mortar tube across his shoulders and belts of linked M60 ammunition crisscrossing his chest. He'd fought in nearly every armed conflict since that October day in 1983 and had served as a sergeant major in the Army's premier special operations unit before going to work for the CIA's ground branch in 2004. The special operations world was a small one, and he and Reese had crossed paths more than once in both Iraq and Afghanistan. 30 seconds out, Ox called over the radio as he wove the green Land Rover Defender 90 toward the firefight around parked and slower-moving cars. He flipped his NODs down as he neared the target, his path illuminated by the vehicle's IR headlights. As soon as he did, he saw the beam from the powerful laser co-witnessed with the sights of the machine gun mounted on the rover's roll bar. He hit the brakes, careful not to bounce his gunner around too badly, and turned sharply. The turn put them perpendicular to the pickup with the enemy totally exposed. Ox winced as the 12.7mm Dishkim machine gun came alive above his head, its 855-grain armor-piercing incendiary bullets tearing the men, their weapons, and the truck behind them to shredded bits of flesh and metal. Ox steered past the pickup and caught sight of the IR beams from Reese's and Freddy's Atpials 200 meters ahead. He accelerated in their direction and saw one of their flashing IR strobes emerge from behind a compact car as he closed the distance. As he rolled to a stop, Reese opened the passenger side door and climbed inside. He heard Freddy tumble into the truck's bed, and the massive gunner, whom they'd nicknamed Django after the movie character, slapped the truck's roof. Ox consulted the night vision-compatible LCD screen attached to the truck's dash as he accelerated away from the objective, confirming over his Peltor headset that their ride was inbound. Reese changed magazines in the passenger seat and looked through the rover's back window to see Strain covering the truck's rear with his rifle. Full head count. He let Ox handle the navigation as he ran through a mental checklist and subconsciously checked over his gear with his left hand. Full mag in the gun and one more in the vest. All Reese could see were buildings lining the darkened city streets as Ox wove his way toward the extraction point, his goggled head shifting between the road ahead and the screen to his right. "Good to see you, buddy," Ox said as he drove. Reese could see his trademark grin below his NODs. "Damn good to see you, Ox. We appreciate the ride." "No worries, man. Somebody's got to keep you Navy guys out of trouble." Ox steered the truck off the road and drove through a side yard between two houses at 50 miles per hour. As they crossed the open field, a black shadow descended before them out of the heavens. The sound came next, the twin blades roaring through the night sky, the rotor wash forcing the high grass flat against the ground. Ox hit the brakes but was still moving at a faster pace than Reese had expected when he steered the Land Rover up the metal ramp of the MH-47G Chinook. It was a tight fit, too tight to open the truck's doors, but the Defender fit into the helicopter's cargo bay like it was made for it. Ox engaged the parking brake and shut off the engine, flashing a thumbs up to the flight engineer. Seconds later, the pilot from the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment added power and lifted off. As the Hilo gained altitude and turned west toward the Adriatic Sea, Amin Nawaz's dead body lay cooling in the back seat of the Opel, his frantic driver speeding to exit the city. Within an hour, cable news outlets were reporting that the terrorist leader had been killed in a raid by Albanian commandos, and an hour after that report, the actual commandos from Albania's Eagle 5 arrived on the scene of the firefight in their Dishkam-armed olive-green Land Rover Defender 90s. Thanks to a tip provided to the nation's state intelligence service, the Albanian Shish recovered the terrorist leader's abandoned body in a discarded vehicle a few kilometers outside Tirana. Chapter 51. Turkey-Iraq Border, September. It took the two-vehicle convoy 10 hours to reach the border. After passing through the town of Silopi, Turkey, Mo and his men crossed the Khabur River and approached the arched frontier gate at Ibrahim Khalil. The men manning the border were Kurdish Peshmerga, the most pro-U.S. troops in Iraq. Despite guarding an international border on behalf of their nation, they wore the sunburst flag of Kurdistan on their U.S.-made woodland BDUs, rather than the flag of Iraq. Kurdistan was a nation within a nation, a place the CIA never really left after 1991. The officer in charge of the checkpoint pointed toward a white Ford F-250 with a PKM machine gun mounted in the rear, operated by a balaclava-wearing Kurd dressed in desert tiger stripe. CIA. The skids had already been greased, and Mo passed through the checkpoint unhindered. Two Ford trucks with gunners manning the big guns in their beds fell in with Mo's van, one in front and one behind. Mo gave them a nod and a thumbs up, following the lead vehicle in what was now a CIA convoy, returning to a country he had vowed never to set foot in again. Mo briefly wondered if Landry would survive the journey. It was a long distance to travel wrapped up in a rug with feet, hands, and mouth secured with duct tape, and decided this was an appropriate time for an inshallah. The agency operated with absolute autonomy in Kurdistan even during the Saddam years. They had organized a coup there in 1995, one that was thwarted not by Hussein or his secret police, but by the National Security Advisor in the White House. The CIA and Iraqi dissidents had planned the coup early in 1995, but at the last minute, the White House lost its nerve. Despite having two divisions and a brigade of the Iraqi army ready to defect to the anti-Saddam forces, agency personnel received a last-minute cable from Washington ordering them to stand down. Mo had no idea whether the plan for a coup would have succeeded, but having seen far too much bloodshed in the chaos that followed Saddam's removal in 2003, he believed the risk would have been worth it. He briefly wondered what his life would be like had that coup succeeded, but quickly brushed the thought aside. He had work to do in the present, an assignment to break and question his treacherous cargo. The tables were turned, and soon Landry would answer for his sins. Chapter 52. Aboard the USS Kearsarge, LHD-3, Adriatic Sea, September. The Chinook landed on the deck of the amphibious assault ship under the cover of darkness, the only illumination on deck coming from a strip of green landing lights. Reese, Strain, Ox, and Django climbed out of the Defender through the top of its roll cage and down the Hilo's rear ramp, while the aircraft and deck crews worked swiftly to move the MH-47 onto the elevator that would take it to a hangar below decks. A desert cami-clad Marine First Lieutenant from the 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit led the men across the deck and inside through a steel hatch. All four commandos squinted as their eyes adjusted to the bright fluorescent lights of the ship's interior while their escort led them through the labyrinth of corridors. Members of the ship's crew stepped aside to let the visitors pass in the narrow space, eyeing the mysterious armed men with curiosity. The beards, nylon chest rigs, and salt-stained multicam combat clothing worn by the agency men contrasted sharply with the blue and gray aquaflage worn by the clean-cut sailors of the conventional Navy.
"Wonder what Admiral ever approved that uniform," Reese thought.
Reese hadn't been able to catch up with Ox much during the flight due to the noise. Now he was directly behind the Army legend as they moved through the bowels of what Reese often termed a big gray ship, due to his mysterious inability to tell them apart.
"Aren't you getting too old for this, Ox? Happy 70th birthday, by the way. Sorry I missed it."
"Easy, Reese. I'm not even 60. Besides, the way my wife spends money, I can't afford to retire.
I can still drive and shoot as long as I don't forget my glasses."
"Well, you must be the Dorian Gray of Redacted."
"Who?" Ox asked.
"Never mind."
"Just don't ask him how to work the comms,"
the usually stoic Django deadpanned over his shoulder.
"Yeah, I need to start bringing one of my grandkids along to work the radios,"
Ox shot back at his partner.
"Why do they make those things so complicated?"
Their marine escort motioned to a closed hatch, and the men shifted to a more professional demeanor as they entered the room for the mission debrief. The room was fairly large by ship standards and was one of the ready rooms for the LHD's helo pilots. A Marine Helicopter Squadron logo adorned the hatch, as well as the podium at the front of the room, where two men and a woman, all dressed in civilian clothes, waited.
"Great job, boys. Fantastic work. Mr. Strain, you and your friend here are going to make me take back all of the bad things I've ever said about SEALs. Mr. Reese, I'm Vic Rodriguez. Very nice to meet you."
Reese was never a great judge of height, but he guessed Rodriguez at 5'6". He was a handsome man with short salt-and-pepper hair and olive skin that made his age hard to guess. Dressed in khaki pants, hiking boots, and a black polo shirt, he was fit and had an energetic air that made him immediately likable. The two men shook hands, Rodriguez smiling warmly. He motioned toward the other individuals in the room and introduced them. Reese recognized Nicole Fan, the analyst from the video conference in Istanbul. She looked even younger in person.
"Guys, this is Major Dave Harper. He's a liaison from
Redacted," Rodriguez said, introducing the thin man with the high and tight haircut.
"Great job out there. I'm just here to coordinate the air, ground, and sea assets for this. Here to help however I can."
"Those helo pilots were nothing short of incredible," Reese said. "Please thank them for us."
"Will do,"
the Army major said with a nod. The ship's galley had the room catered, and the food, true to Navy form, was actually not bad, though Reese hadn't forgotten the differences between eating in the officer's mess and the enlisted one, night and day. Reese and Freddy ate like they'd been shipwrecked for weeks before beginning the hot wash. He led them through each phase of the mission, answering questions from Rodriguez, Fan, and Harper as they went. The UAV images were displayed on the room's LCD screen, and the men gave play-by-play narratives from their perspective on the ground. Reese had been through hundreds of similar debriefs during his time in special operations, though none were as sensitive or as classified as this one. Following the 3-hour meeting, Harper called for an escort to show the men to their assigned sleeping quarters. Rodriguez shook Reese's hand on the way out and spoke in a muted voice.
"Great work, Reese. Get some sleep. There's something I want to discuss with you in the morning."
Reese bid him good night, wondering what the morning's conversation would entail.
Chapter 53.